Welcome back, everybody. It's Uncensored CMO. Now, one question I get a lot is, will I do more B2B episodes? It turns out there's a lot of you out there that want to hear from B2B CMOs. Now, in this episode, I'm joined by Michelle Tate. She is the CMO of MailChimp. Now, I don't know if you know, but MailChimp was acquired by Intuit for $12 billion just 2.5 years ago. And Michelle was tasked with taking over as a CMO to lead the growth and expansion of the brand. There is so much in this episode, lots of advice about how you market to other marketers and much more besides. I know you're going to enjoy it. Here's my conversation with Michelle. Michelle, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, I thought we'd start talking about sneakers, if that's all right, because I believe you know, your career began designing sneakers. That sounds like a really fun job. I think if I invented something to do, that would be probably what I'd do. But is it as fun as it sounds?
It is. Although I do look at people from the ground up these days.
Oh, do you?
I just got used to it, and I tend to remember their shoes faster than their names.
I'm suddenly having a little bit self-conscious moment thinking, what am I wearing now? Is it rude to ask you how many sneakers you have?
No, my 9-year-old asks me all the time why. I have, and this is why I know the number, I have 129 pairs of shoes.
Whoa.
A lot of them are sneakers.
There's a lot of people out there going, respect. Are you still loyal to New Balance? Have you got lots of New Balance, or you diversified your collection? You really get into trouble.
It took me, no kidding, it took me 5 years post New Balance to wear Nikes.
Do you still feel a little bit naughty?
Sort of buying,
you know, it's hard to get, you know, I worked for Pepsi for about 12 years, and there were a few years where it felt naughty to get a Diet Coke. I was like, I can't do that, you know.
Is anyone watching?
Yeah, exactly. I'm going to get escorted out of the premises if they see me, you know. What's the secret to a great, great trainer?
I think great insight into the customer, right? Like, what are they using you for? I worked on lifestyle shoes, and I worked on cross-training shoes. And I remember at the time it was women's cross-trainers. And it was just at the beginning when we realized that you didn't need such a thick sole to truly be a great cross-trainer. And the reason we got to a thinner sole was because women just said, hey, I want to look a little sexy. I want to look nice in these shoes. They don't need to be so bulky. And then we started looking at what they're actually doing with them and what we could fit inside. So yeah.
Fashion and insight. Function, then. It's got to do both, right?
You know, there you go.
Can't be too functional. Now, so from New Balance, you went to Unilever, didn't you? Which is quite a big move. So what was Unilever culture like? Because that's one of those companies that everyone admires, you know, some of the best marketers in the world kind of there. What did you learn at Unilever?
I'm so grateful for my time at Unilever. And the culture is phenomenal in that just great people, super smart, looking to move the world with I would say some of the most basic consumer goods, right? I learned a ton. I learned positioning. My first rotation there was on Magnum ice cream, launching Magnum ice cream in North America. So, you know, I'd lived in Europe. I never realized that Magnum ice cream was so big. It was the number one ice cream brand in the world, at least at the time. Hadn't been launched here because it was, here ice cream is a value category, right? It's driven by price, or at least was at the time. And so we were launching what we would call a super premium sticks bar, right? And essentially we ended up launching Chanel on a stick. And to have the ability to like go from here's an ice cream bar to here's the most clever positioning and sell out in the first week, just phenomenal.
The Unilever does so well. It's the same in the UK, actually. It used to be, we used to buy like really big tubs of vanilla ice cream. I think Wool's was the brand. In fact, I think it's owned by Unilever now, but it's like very cheap. It's everyone had the same flavor sort of thing. And then Magnum is like 3 or 4 times the price, but the flavors, the indulgence, the design, the marketing, everything, all the P's, they just absolutely nailed, didn't they? And
created
a powerful brand. And what about purpose as well? Because obviously Unilever is quite famous for its purpose. And I think you worked on Dove as well, didn't you? Which is another, you know, legendary brand.
Yeah, I spent the last 3 years of my career there on Dove Body Wash, and it was a phenomenal experience. You know, there's something really energizing waking up with a purpose that you truly believe in. And what I find interesting and I so adore and inspired by with Unilever is even when you have a brand that has a master brand, essentially, right, with a true purpose, the categories actually have to do a lot of work to define who they are and why they are differentiated. And so having that duality and not just leaning on the purpose as the foundation for the work, I thought was phenomenal. But yeah, I mean, you just learn a very intense discipline of marketing right? As it relates to positioning and the connection between functional and emotional, and also just the value of consistency with purpose, right? And innovating on that.
What would be your favorite sort of thing that you did in your time at Unilever? Does anything stand out particularly as you're most proud of?
It's going to sound crazy, but I think it was 2 years before I left, we launched a campaign called Dish Soap, where we compared other soaps that women were using in the shower to the to dish soap, because that's what essentially the ingredients were. And we were trying to get that stark difference of it might feel similar, but this is really what you're showering with. And we took women into a spa and we said, we're going to have you try a product. And it was real women, right? And we had them try dish soap, and the reactions just off of that, of, you know, they got into the shower as this beautiful spa and they were like, dish soap? Never.
Really?
Yeah. And it was one of our most stellar and best performing campaigns.
A clever reframing, isn't it?
Yeah.
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 Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah. And here you go. Take purpose and take the positioning and then take amazing differentiation and category, right?
Yeah. Well, I think your career has almost been my kind of dream one, you know, sneaker design and then through to ice cream and Dove. I mean, it sounds amazing. So you had a lot of fun. Now, and then you move from the world of CPG, you know, very, very marketing led. I mean, Unilever are one of the most marketing led organizations, consumer orientated in the world, aren't they? To the world of SaaS, right? That's a big jump, isn't it? Like, you know, what inspired the move and how did you find the change from one to the other?
I was afraid at the time that what we then called digital marketing, now it's called marketing,
yeah.
Right? Would just eat up everything that is not data-backed. And it's not fair to say that CPG isn't data-backed, but it just felt like it was moving so much faster outside of CPG, and I really wanted to make that move. And I'm a continuous learner. I love learning to a fault. And so, yeah, that's what made me move. I wanted to move to a company that had an inspiring mission. I really got a lot of energy working on Dove, and working at Intuit, you really come to work to power prosperity around the world for small businesses, for consumers. Was grateful to have gotten the opportunity to work on QuickBooks as my first role. My first role was repositioning, rebranding QuickBooks around the world from, as we went from accounting software to a suite of business tools where small businesses could run their business, essentially. So that was sort of what propelled the move.
That's pretty cool, actually, because I mean, I run a tiny, tiny business, almost not a business with the podcast, but sort of got a little bit of insight into it. And it's all the things that, you know, you want to do what you are good at. You want to do the thing that your business is about. And then you've got all this other stuff to take care of, the accountancy and everything else. So making that easy is quite a big deal. You know, it's quite a, you know, big value to the world, isn't it? To a sport, because in big companies, you've got huge departments, haven't you? Kind of all set up to take care of it. And then you're in a small business, like, oh, I've got to do this now.
And you don't want to, right?
It's not what you started business to do, is it?
It's not what you started to do, yeah. You know? And that's a core insight that we were looking at, which is it's so complex and so daunting to run your business. It is also very rewarding and liberating, but it is so unpredictable and at times very lonely. And so how do you sort of bring a brand to champion those who essentially are consumers who decided to work for themselves, right?
Yeah. And a lot of people out there trying to do it as well. And it's quite a scary thing to do, isn't it? I mean, particularly if you've come from maybe a corporate job, like the sort of jobs we've done, and then you're suddenly on your own without the infrastructure around you. And probably they're the things you keep you up at night worrying about, how do I invoice? When's the money going to come in? And how do I do this tax return that I've now got to do?
Yeah. And I think that's what drove me to Intuit. My grandfather was an entrepreneur and he did a bunch of things and probably a bunch of them wrong. But he always said to me, do what you love, right? And he just went on and found the things that he loved, but never knew how to do his accounting, never knew how to figure out the books. But at Intuit, it was sort of the power of many for the prosperity of one. And so how do you use that big data to bring to life and the prosperity and the wins and the ease, right, as you run that business?
Yeah, well, it makes sense. And then let's move on to MailChimp, of course, which is where you are now. Just give us a sense of the what the business is, why it's become so successful. We've got a lot of customers. So just for anyone who's not currently a MailChimp customer, maybe let them know a bit about it.
Yeah, so MailChimp is a 20-year-old business that we are the number one email and marketing automations platform in the world. It started off as an email platform for solopreneurs and small businesses. As we acquired it about 2.5 years ago at Intuit, We've been taking it up market into mid-market and really servicing advanced marketers as we've expanded the roadmap. And it's really a business that fuels or provides radical momentum for any ambition. If in the past it's been sort of the business that empowers the underdog, right now it's about whatever your ambition is, we'll give you the tools to get there. And I would say, I would take it one step further. MailChimp has been really, really successful because it's connected to its customers. And that's on many levels, through inspiration and education and the right tools and engagement over time. And that's sort of what's differentiated it in the eyes of its customers, and it allowed it to grow. And it's funny, we talked to a lot of marketers who started with us and are now sort of reconsidering us, right, as we've provided the advanced tools for them. And they've watched us for a really long time. They watched the incredible marketing that the brand has done. And so they're willing to really have a conversation with us as a result of this respect.
And you talked about being close to the customer. I remember I once, back to my days when I worked with Pepsi, we used to have like a day a month where we'd all go out in the vans, you know, to store, and we'd sort of fill the shelves. And I remember the team I ran was going, oh, John, do we have to? Like, it's a whole day out in this. But it was the best day out we ever had, because at the end of it, everyone's like buzzing with ideas and like, oh, I've met people that drink our brands. And I never realized that the box we put it in doesn't fit the shelf perfectly. And, you know, they'll just discover stuff that was wrong about the packaging, you know, it was small details. But it really taught me something, that kind of that time in my career, about how important it is to spend time with customers, really, because you learn so much about, you know, about what you're selling, that you can easily forget in a meeting room, you know, talking about positioning and strategy, and you need to get out there. But how do you maintain that closeness to customer when you've got so many of them out there and you're now quite a, you know, big organization?
We spend a lot of time with them. It is the answer. We surely look at data and trends and, at scale, but I spend about an hour a week with customers all over the world. And a lot of the times you don't even tell them that you're from MailChimp, right? Like, you just want to hear what's on their mind. What are they thinking about? How are they coping with the challenges that they have? A lot of marketers were trying to understand, what else are they connecting to on the business? Who are the additional players in the game, right? How do you sort of take the onus off of them? What other connections can you make that sort of accelerate their work and make them look like heroes and feel really confident? But really, there is no solution to just spending time with customers. Yeah.
I like your phrase there about making them heroes, because I think that's a secret. A lot of marketing, isn't it? Particularly B2B marketing, is how do you make your customer the hero, help them to achieve what they want to achieve? And I suppose that's what you're doing for millions of people all at once, aren't you?
Yeah.
You talked about marketing to marketers. Have you moved from, because you described it before as solopreneurs, didn't you, as the origins of the business. Are you moving in terms of into bigger organizations and enabling larger organizations to succeed as well?
Yeah, we are marketing to marketers. It's a skeptical bunch.
Like, we know what you're doing here. Like, you know, they're cynical, aren't they?
I've never loved a job so much.
I like it. What's the trick to marketing to marketers then?
Well, marketers think about two things. They think about a lot of things, but yeah, big bucket, two things. One is the business, right? They're highly competitive and they're driven by a lot of FOMO, me included, in that you just want to get it to a better place. You constantly want to optimize. You constantly want to get to business results, higher ROI, because they are doing a lot more with a lot less. And every year it just gets harder, right? And the numbers don't get lower every year.
Funny thing, that, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. And then the other thing is, they really care about creativity. And so that comes to life in sort of what they do off-platform and in their spare time. And that might be music or the creative process or going to exhibits if you're in London, right? And so we share a lot of conversation with them, or we try to show up naturally where they're at as it relates to creativity. We recently did a collaboration with Bjork on Sonic Symbolism, a podcast series about her creative process as she launched her 10th album. We launched Email is Dead, as you know, at the London Design Museum, knowing that our customers were essentially going to galleries already, right? And their spare time. And so what a great place to show up and talk about the cultural power of email. We showed up at New York Fashion Week. So we really think about those two components. Yeah.
And just to check, email's not dead, right? Just to clear this up for
everyone
listening.
Email is very much not dead.
Very much has alive and kicking and is still doing the results. Yeah?
You know, it's mind-boggling to me that email has a $42 ROI on the dollar globally. It is the highest ROI channel, except we just don't think about it in that way.
Is that because there's so many other things that are being marketed to marketers? You know, AI maybe being the latest thing. Have we forgotten the basics? Is that why? Or just need to do a better job of marketing email?
I think we don't think of email as core marketing. We often if you think about marketing teams, they often spend a ton of time on acquisition and not necessarily as much time on engagement, retention, re-engagement, right? Reactivation. It costs 5x to acquire a customer than to actually re-engage them and cross-sell or resell. That's in fact a lot of the insight that we've seen with in speaking to customers and marketers. They just don't necessarily think about it as much as a growth channel. And those who have lifecycle teams, right, who have figured out the growth hack, are seeing a lot of great results. Yeah,
yeah, definitely.
But it's not dead.
It's not dead. Just to clarify, everyone, it's alive and kicking, and MailChimp can help, of course. You started obviously at a very interesting time for the business, didn't you? Because you know, just taken over. That's quite a challenge, right? Because you're coming in and you know, Intuit has obviously bought the business. How did you approach that challenge of integrating a, you know, 20-year-old successful business into a larger one?
Yeah, it's such a huge challenge, and I don't think I knew what I was walking into. You think as a business leader, you're walking into a business challenge. And what I've learned about the acquisition is it's really a people challenge and then a business challenge. And first and foremost, it's about building trust. And you can't do anything until you build that trust. But what was interesting for me was MailChimp was a brand I admired for so many years because of the mix of design and creativity and craft and marketing. It was a brand that I would just, you know, adored, right? And so walking in, I was equally as scared of screwing it up, right? The team on the ground was of the acquiring party. And so building trust from a place where you really just want to understand what makes the magic happen here. People are really afraid to speak at the very get-go means you have to put everything aside and just focus on people and focus on relationships. And that's what we did. We communicated a ton. I really hate awkward silences, as my team will tell you. And so, you know, we had a few of those, but we kiboshed them very quickly. But it was really about a ton of communication, some shared goals, figuring out, you know, what we saw similarly, what we saw differently.
Yeah. And how do you get the balance between the Intuit way of doing things maybe and the MailChimp way of doing it? Were there different ways that the businesses approached each other or how sort of Intuit did MailChimp have to be?
You know, culturally, I think Intuit and MailChimp were very similar. And they both at the core really, really care about customers. And so from that standpoint, we kind of moved in similar ways. But I think it was a little bit of, tell us how you do this, tell us how you do this, right? And a lot of the beginnings were about, help us find the right way to track the business and help us understand how you track and how you look at it. And then on the brand side is sort of, where is the magic? How does the magic happen? And how do we sort of unleash that? And Intuit is very customer obsessed, but is also is known for its sort of customer backed performance, right? And so bringing some of that to a business that was very much brand led was a great challenge. And I remember at the beginning talking a lot to my team about how do we hit this fine line of where creativity meets performance. And the brand isn't afraid to show off all of its new roadmap as you go up market, and you really need to show that you've advanced. And we found a way, and it was very much based in consumer insight. And even if you look at our the campaigns that we launched together, the first campaign that we launched, Guest Less, Sell More, was really about that moment of insight that we know when our customers send really complex email campaigns, there's that moment, and you tell me if you have this, right? But there's that moment you're like, am I really sending this? Is this the best thing that I can do? Are we ready to go? And then you press send, and it's like this, oh, am I? I'm kind of, you know, second guessing myself. Is this the best that I can do? And we found that that was a very common sort of feeling within our customers. And we based a whole campaign off of you know, how are you seeing the world? And then how does MailChimp see it? And then the second was the customer. And the customer is a ball of customers, essentially, that rolls into a room.
Right. Yeah.
If you haven't seen it, we'll certainly share it. But it was based off of this insight as we were speaking to customers that, you know, they were saying, I have a customer problem. And in fact, they had a customer problem because they were treating all of their customers in the same way rather than thinking about hyper-personalized sort of communication that would really drive their engagement. So at the end of the day, I think a lot of that Intuit ethos around customer was very much shared, and it was just unlocking sort of how we do it together.
You had a lovely phrase where creativity meets performance, because there's a constant debate in marketing, isn't it? Are we a performance-led business or are we a creative-led business? And I love how you brought the two together, because of course it's true, isn't it? You know, that we know creativity is the thing that, you know, makes, gets a huge, you know, emotional response in the audience and makes them act. But sometimes we can be so performance, you know, led that we forget that that's the magic, you see. And I liked your phrase as well, where the magic happens, which is a lovely way of doing it. So how do you get that balance between kind of creative and performance? And how did you get to that? Because I think there's something quite rich in there.
First and foremost, based off of customer insight, right? And then constant testing, of course. But I think there's also just if you know your customer and you know your brand really, really well, you're able to do things that are sort of more magical and more out there because you know where the guidelines are. When I was at New Balance, I really wanted, at some point, I realized I wanted to work in marketing, or the dark side of marketing, as my design friends would say. And I desperately tried to get a marketing job, and nobody would give me a marketing job because they said I was too creative. I couldn't prove that I was analytical.
You're too creative.
Yeah. There was nothing to showcase based off my background that I was analytical. And so I went to get an MBA, and I proved to the world that I could do spreadsheets. But I just don't believe in
this. Your competitive side coming out again there.
A little bit. I just don't believe that it's one or the other, right? And I showcased that to the team. And I think coming into MailChimp, there was a real fear that we as an Intuit would take over with full-on performance and the magic of the brand would go away. But it's about how do you utilize that creativity to drive performance. And we've actually changed a lot of the brand work to service performance. So I'll give you some examples. The email is dead exhibit, and we've established it's not,
it's
right?
It's not.
But is really, or was really, in service not only of thought leadership of showcasing to the UK, we're the number one email and marketing automations platform, and we can help the market understand the value and the cultural power of email. But it was very much a talking piece at the time, right? But also collected tens of thousands of marketers' email addresses as part of a very smartly and very thoughtfully crafted exhibit, right? That was very interactive. And so that is first party data that we then nurture. And we have a very, you know, you have to use it very carefully because otherwise people opt out, right? Which is very much, very interesting in an email game, different than ads or, right? It's not just pushed at you. You get to say whether you want to be in this relationship or not. And so, yeah, we utilize that as first-party data. We did the same with New York Fashion Week. We really think about how do we bring the brand to life, but how does that then bring back first-party data that allows us to build that thoughtful journey that compounds and where we get to learn more about you and you get to tell us what you're interested in or what you need from us so we can better service you.
Yeah. And it sounds like from the kind of activation you're talking about, you're going higher end in terms of the audience as well, aren't you? In terms of, you know, the bigger teams, more senior people maybe.
Yeah.
As well. And I'm making an assumption here. They're probably the more likely ones to opt out than opt in, aren't they? When you go up.
The stakes are higher, right? Yeah. You really need to understand them well. You need to find them where it matters.
It's funny, you're talking a bit before there about being too creative. I had the opposite of my career. So I did a economics and finance degree and then decided I wanted to get into marketing. And I applied for my first brand manager job and I didn't get it because it was on Pepsi Max. And it's like my dream job. Pepsi Max was a bit like Mountain Dew kind of positioning. It was really cool. And they said I was too analytical. And I was like, I've got all these ideas to share. I know what's doing the brand. So it took me a while actually to kind of, I did the opposite to you. I had to prove my creativity and the numbers are there in the first place. But it is the You're absolutely right. Marketing is about the blending. It's measuring and magic, isn't it, together? And the magic is coming up with ideas and solutions and creativity that will solve business problems and deliver the results. But we forget that. We either become so obsessed with data and process, or we become, you know, so kind of wild and, you know, let loose on creativity. But it's pulling the two things together is the key, isn't it?
My hope is also that with AI, that'll be the equalizer.
Ooh,
you don't necessarily,
ooh, yes,
right? You know, you can use it as a buddy for creative concepting. You can, and we've used it in creative concepting really, really well. You can use it as a buddy for the analytical crunching, right? Mm. And so we'll see how that pans out.
Did a really interesting experiment, actually, the other day. A guy I worked with, Noah Breer, we did this thing called a Turing test. And we went out to, we got a bunch of art students to kind of design an out-of-home campaign. And then we asked AI to design an out-of-home campaign. And we were basically measuring on a 5-star scale, right, in terms of, we then tested them both with the audience and see how they did. The students got 1.8 stars out of 5. 1.83 stars, to be correct. AI got 1.8 stars. So they got almost an exact match, which I thought was quite impressive.
Yeah.
But there's a little twist. We had to exclude one of the students because we found they cheated. One group of students got 2.7 because they'd used AI and their own ideas. And of course, there's the answer. It's like,
it really
is. That was the answer, basically. We suddenly discovered, by accident, we were like, hang on a second, these guys have gamed the system. And then we thought, well, of course, you know, they were using it to improve and iterate on the ideas that they came up with.
Yeah, well, so we have an in-house agency, Wink. They are our pride and joy and our secret sauce, I call them. And we do all the concepting in-house. And so for the customer campaign, they presented the concept to me. And if you've seen the customer, it's really hard to just like create a board from nothing with the customer visual. But they actually created, as they pitched it to me, they created a visual of the customer. And we had a really good debate about what the customer would look like, how it would come to life, different iterations of the customer. And so it was a show versus tell, which is really helpful, right? And I think we went from 4 concepts to just 1 in a week. And it really sped up the creative process for us. And then what we were able to do is we took that into testing, and we used Midjourney to craft some of those visuals for the testing, not the final visuals. But we tested it in multiple countries. And during, you know, when you do groups, you either have animatics or you have boards, but it's really hard to change the content in between groups when you have 15 minutes in between. We actually changed the content utilizing AI and the learnings between groups. And then we ended up producing what we thought would be the best camp or the best assets. We then tested them with Ipsos. They are at the top 1% of ads globally in their database. And I really attribute that to, one, our amazing team, but them working with AI and just continuously getting better.
Going back to your sneaker experience, actually, I had had a really cool one last year. I don't know if you remember, but Nike did a collaboration with Tiffany.
Yeah.
I don't know if you remember that. And I looked at the app and I thought, I could design that myself. It looked pretty basic. Right? It basically had the Tiffany unique color of blue, whatever it is, you know, that color on the swoosh. And anyway, so we put it into an innovation test on the same 5-point scale, and it came in at 2.5. And anyway, so I thought I'd go and consult my friend Noah again. And I said, put this into AI, see if AI can design a better collab with Tiffany. 5-star. Because what it did is it created loads of concept, but it created what you would imagine a Tiffany designed Nike trainer to look like, sort of thing. So it was quite bling. It was like, the blue was everywhere. It's absolutely magical. But we tested a whole load and we found one that was 5-star. And that would have been the top 1% of all tests we've ever done.
Right.
So it just shows, you know, even Nike, who we admire and think are the best in the world at something, but I think the interesting thing is that you had to feed it the idea. You had to say, take the best assets of Tiffany, take this Nike Air Force trainer, put them together, and what do you get? So that's quite cool. Now, talking about brand as well, one of the things I love about MailChimp is how simple and impactful your design is as well, and also with the chimp as well. It's
Freddy,
brilliant.
Yeah.
I know. I didn't know till today that it was called Freddy, so that's really good. So how important is having a distinctive brand asset, having kind of the color palette? I know that even the yellow has got its own kind of name as well, doesn't it? So how important is that to building the brand and helping get recognition?
Very important, right? It's one of the things that SaaS can learn from CPG for sure. I talk a lot with my team about we don't want to be the B2B that is boring to boring. We want to be breakthrough and brilliant. And part of that is really about, you know, it is about being differentiated. We, for years, and this is predates me quite a lot, the brand has always been known as the expert absurdist. So we're really, really crisp and really clear about the business results that we deliver. And when you're in the moment and you're looking for segmentation or automation or whatever it is that you're doing with us, we are very, very in the business with you. But we have this irreverence. We have this sort of, I would say, just absurd feel, right? We don't take ourselves too seriously because we know our customers don't. And at the end of the day, we're talking to humans, right? Regardless if you're B2C or B2B, there is a human there. And yeah, so that allows us to be a really bold yellow in a sea of blues and greens and really shine out. I also think if you think about and you look at Freddie, I would actually say, look at his wink. His wink is everything. It signals the we get you, we got you. We'll provide any tool in our toolbox to give you the power of, you know, an enterprise marketer. But at the same time, we get that you're a person, and we'll give you some comic relief. We'll give you some inspiration, depending on where you're at. One of the things I remember from my first year on the brand is the team launched a game called Dumpling Delivery. I don't know if you've seen it.
Sounds good.
It's the most simplistic and funny game. You basically are golfing with your mouse, but you're golfing a dumpling. And it shows up in our product, right? So it's like, it's kind of, people think about SaaS as like product or brand. It's actually brand in the product, right? And it shows up based off of a consumer insight that marketers don't stop for a minute, that they have really, really long to-do lists and they don't give themselves a breather. And so team figured out if we could get them to golf for 5 minutes, right, then we could give them some mental relief that is much needed to truly be at your best for creativity. So, yeah, I think that's where
really
like the
insight.
Brand comes to life in multiple ways and multiple places, but very clearly in that expert absurdist nature.
Yeah. Because I think if you ask anyone, where were you when you came up with that idea, right? Most people are not going to say at my desk in a meeting while getting my emails done. You know what I mean? It's usually like I was on a walk or I was having a break or I was chatting to a friend, you know, that's where creativity happens, isn't it? So, yeah.
And that's where like real attachment happens to brands, right?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm a big fan of the brand. Obviously, you know, almost as much as my own podcast, actually, because I was like, yeah, we got the yellow. Exactly. Yeah, we got that. But you kind of blend, you know, in fact, when I did the research for this podcast, looking for a design, I looked up, you know, tech brands and podcast brands. They're all blue and white and gray. I mean, it's like a sea of the same.
Yeah.
And I thought, yeah, yellow will stand out and all that lot. And the inspiration for me just came from a post-it note. I was just like, what do post-it notes do? They're there to stand out amongst all your work. Yeah. And they're the most important thing you look at to remind you sort of thing. I was like, right, post-it note yellow. so something in there, we've got that in common. So that's really good. I'd love to talk to you a bit about products as well, because there's always a challenge in marketing and SaaS, isn't it? Is it a product-led business where marketing supports, or actually are the marketers that are close to customers creating the products? How is it in MailChimp? Do you and your team get to kind of help come up with what the product should be in the future as well?
Yeah. I think about Intuit at large and this sort of customer obsession, which I recognize I'm saying a lot, but it is just core to the DNA of the company. So every function every function knows the customer. And so every function has insight and can feed into the roadmap. What I find really fun about MailChimp is I'm the marketer on the leadership team feeding into the marketing roadmap, right? Essentially. And marketing to marketers is just, it's really fun. But you really are the BS meter, right? Mm-hmm. In terms of, yeah, we can launch a feature, but if it doesn't connect to the rest of the features, it's actually not going to provide value. You can really have thoughtful conversations around the journey and around the impact that you're having in the broader context of the marketing org or the marketing journey that our customers are trying to build. So, Yeah. But at the end of the day, you know, we're trying to help our marketers create better engagements, better connection with their customers. And so being the marketing team on that type of business is really powerful.
I love that insight. I very occasionally do training for agencies, actually helping them pitch their products. And my very, very, very first point whenever I do the training is your customer has a customer. And everyone forgets this, you know, because they just see the next customer as well, that they're it. And I said, if you can make them a hero and make them look good, they'll love you forever. You know, make their job easier, make them more successful, make them famous, you know. And I remember I had once had a very, very important customer in an old job. He was the most influential person in the category that I was selling in, sort of thing. And we're up very late at the bar. He turned around to me and said, how are you going to get me promoted? And I thought, well, first of all, I thought, what an ego. I thought, come on, that's like a ridiculous thing to say. But the more I thought about it, I thought, what if I could come up with something so good that he actually got promoted because of what we did together? I thought, that's not bad, is it? And in a weird sense, you're kind of doing something, you know, how do you make all your customers successful? What would you say the, marketing to marketers, I think, is a really interesting concept, isn't it? What makes, how do you make marketing to marketers work? What would be your top tips for anyone else listening that's thinking, I need to market to marketers?
I mean, at the core of it, it's really about showing up naturally at the, in the places where, you know, where they're at and what, where they care about what they're looking at or experiencing, but doing it naturally, right? And understanding that they're going to have a relationship with you that is on and off platform, and you're the same brand, right? And so how you show up really matters, and the consistency of that experience matters, but also the compounding nature of that experience matters. So we may be heard. Maybe one of our customers would hear Sonic Symbolism, right, as a podcast, as part of like their creative curiosity. That is not an immediate get. It is not a short-term sale. That is one of many points of view. And it starts to build thought leadership around MailChimp being part of the creative process. And if MailChimp knows creativity and marketing, what might it do from a tools perspective, right? But you have to connect those dots thoughtfully and over time. Yeah, the other thing for marketers is just you need to, I think the most impactful piece for MailChimp that I've noticed that is just magical but has been honed in for years and years is understanding pop culture and understanding pop culture in multiple regions, which is easy to say, hard to do, really, really hard to do.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. It's hard to, isn't it? Particularly, you know, with so many different countries. Presumably you're global, aren't you? You're like everywhere.
Yeah, 190 countries.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah. And then, you have to come in with the goods. Like, you're marketing to marketers. you need to know.
That's the tough audience, right?
Yeah. And so having data really matters. Having data about what's going on around them and making sure that they know. Like, our data suggests that 9 out of 10 marketers recognize that they need to use AI to grow their business. Only half of them do. And then when you take a step back and you ask, well, what's getting in your way? It's really about resources, right? And so really understanding what it is that they need and sort of serving it up in the way that is digestible to them.
One of the best data points I've come across recently was the Ehrenberg Bass B2B data that said 95% of people are not in the market to buy what you're selling today, right?
Yeah.
And this is what I loved about your in and in out of market point, because as marketers, we need to obsess about the 95. And I mean, in my job, I kind of decided what I'm going to do is create immense value for marketers for free, so that at some point when they are deciding to buy, I'm just top of mind. You know, but making that case can be quite hard, can't it? Because people are going, well, where's the return today? Where's the percentage conversion and all that sort of thing? So getting the balance between both, I think, is a trick, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's why we've sort of pivoted to a data-first approach, where regardless of whether they buy now or buy later, we're starting to have a conversation with them. We're starting to engage.
How do you value the buy later bit? Because that's always the conundrum, isn't it? It's like you look at your measures. The buy now is, in a way, that's not easy, is it? But I mean, it's very measurable, right? How many people clicked and bought and signed up, sort of thing. But how do you measure the people that may buy in the future and how that bit's working?
I would compare it to thinking about measurement on TV. It's just about flipping how you think about top of funnel and how do you fill that funnel,
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, in my day job, we've done something similar where we've kind of looked at the kind of fame level. We've got partners that we work with. We've got sort of, we call it kind of thought leadership as well. And then we've got obviously people that are coming into us to talk to us. And in each part of that funnel, we've got quite clear KPIs in terms of numbers of people and growth and conversion as well. So, yeah. But it's often the trick, isn't it, to realize that it is a funnel and they're actually the different stages. And everyone gets so obsessed about the bottom bit. But actually, if you fill the top bit more, then the bottom bit takes care of itself is the magic, isn't it? And then, you know, becomes a lot easier if you've got the top bit sorted. Now, you've had some incredible jobs and I'm very envious of your kind of new balance to ice cream to Dove to MailChimp. So it's been quite a career.
For what it's worth, when I started on Magnum ice cream, I was lactose intolerant.
No, were you? How did that work out for you when you did the product sampling?
I couldn't resist it. So
were you taking the hit anyway?
So. Yes, I was. And I built up the tolerance. So
wow. I didn't know that's possible. So you could actually train your way through it, couldn't you?
Yeah.
Well, it's worth it, right?
So. Yeah, totally.
So but you've had a lovely diverse experience. What would you say as a CMO, what have you learned? What would be your top kind of like takeaways in terms of how to succeed across quite a wide variety of roles?
You know, I've thought about this a lot recently, and I think it comes down to connection and how do you figure out what works for you in terms of how do you build connection. For us, it's, and I always say when people ask me, what's your advice? I would say, if in doubt, connect. And I think about that connection and building meaningful connection is sort of three pillars. One is bring out that soulful subjectivity. So if we're wired to connect in one of two ways, one is transactional and one is sort of, I want to become part of something that is more of a collective that I aspire to, that I care about. You want to be in that second bucket, right? And the only way to be in that second bucket is to bring your whole self to the game and have people self-select to interact with you. And we do that with our fun character, right? And our very bold yellow, to your point, Cavendish. And the second is sincere personalization. Like, think about how you utilize people's data to give them value. If soulful subjectivity is about building trust, then think about once you've got their trust, how do you give them added value? And the third is sort of shared courage and building shared courage with your customers and not being afraid to bring those two first components to the game. We went to one of our competitors' conferences last minute. We bought out all of the out of home in Boston and around their conference. And we had all of the cabs there plastered in our, wrapped in our branding. And what we did was we gave people who were going to the conference where we knew mid-market marketers were attending. And it was really important for us to say, hey, we're here, right? And we should be top of mind for you. We gave free rides from hotels to the conference to people. And in those rides, we played some fun entertaining assets and some educational assets. And it was, you know, maybe not the biggest splash, but it was very targeted and it had a lot of courage to it. And people loved it. They were standing in line to take our taxis or our cabs. So have the courage to have a dumpling delivery game show up in your product. Have the courage to, you know, get an exhibit out rather than, you know, pay for TV. So those three pieces sort of ladder back up into meaningful connection. And I always say that craft yields connection and connection yields craft. And so that's really what I would say.
Oh, that's beautifully put. I love those three things, how you put it together. And the courage thing is absolutely great key, isn't it? And that's a brilliant thing to inspire to. Amazing. Michelle, thank you so much. It's been great. And thank you for giving up the time to talk about it. It's been great to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much for listening or watching Uncensored CMO. I hope you enjoyed that. If you did, please do hit the subscribe button wherever you get your podcast. And if you're watching, hit subscribe there as well. I'd also love to get a review. Reviews make a big difference on other people discovering the show. So please do leave a review wherever you get your podcast. If you want to contact me, you can do. I'm over on X at Uncensored CMO or on LinkedIn where I'm under my own name, John Evans. Thanks for listening and watching. I'll see you next time.